Succession number 23812, Reel 13.
Mr. Doyle, Reel 13. So, after the collapse of the first bridge, what happened next, please?
Well, the Japanese were not to be outdone by the fact that this bridge, which was, as it turned out, to be a temporary bridge anyway. But we understood that from Java, the Japanese had taken down one of these metal bridges, which were metal span bridges, and this was to be used for what one, if you went to the River Kwai now, you would see stretching across the River Kwai. That had to be constructed. Now, I have just related as to how the wooden bridge was constructed by these little islands of as we pile drove these stakes in and filled it with earth. Now, exactly the same thing we started to do. We didn't know exactly what reason or no, but once again we constructed these islands of earth across the River Kwai. And we then had to put wood structures in a circle on top of this earth mound inside these little islands. We would put an inner circle and an outer circle, and probably the distance between the inner and the outer circle would be somewhere around about, as we would know, about 2 to 2.5 foot. So we put these wooden circles on these earth mounds. Now, what on earth was going to happen now, we wondered. Well, we then built structures over these little islands, and along came these concrete mixers, and we used these concrete mixers, and we had to fill up in between the inner and outer circle of these mouldings with concrete. Right, so once that had reached the top level of the two circular constructions, we then put two more mounds round on top of the other moulds, two circular inner and outer moulds. We then filled that with concrete. So when it reached a certain height, we then had to get inside the inner circle where the earth was, and we had to remove this earth. And we would do so by chaps standing on top of the concrete mounds, and we would use chunkles, and we would fill up these baskets with earth from inside these moulds. And the chaps would then tip the earth into the river. Well, we had no idea what this was for, but being very ingenious people, despite the fact of their treatment of us and their fanaticism, they were very skilled at what they were doing, these Japanese and engineers. Well, what happens when you draw away earth from an inner circle, of which I've explained, as you take away the earth, you would suddenly find, if you were standing on top of those concrete moulds, that they would suddenly move, and they would sink. And the more earth you took out, then the further they would sink. And so you'd put another mould on the top. So that was above the water level. And so on and so forth. So you kept taking earth out, until you get right into the river, down to the riverbed itself. And that meant that the concrete circles were eventually resting on the riverbed. This was quite a horrendous thing, because when you were down and you got below the level of the water, it became very cold. Up the top, it was tropical conditions, except in the monsoons. But whilst you were down there, it was absolutely icy. You had no clothes. And as the water seeped in, you know, one had to be very careful you didn't drown. So eventually the Japanese got some pumps, they were sort of a petrol pump. But unfortunately the fumes used to fill up the inner circle of the of which I've just described into the riverbed, and therefore some chaps were passing out, which meant, of course, they were breathing in carbon monoxide, I suppose it would be, I don't know. But anyway, it passed out. So to continue the work down there, one could only stay down there a short period of time. Otherwise, you became unconscious. So we were pulled up, and then somebody would have to go down, and you would continue. This went on until they were satisfied that the construction was well bedded into the river bed.
Yeah.
These were to become these big concrete piles were to become eventually what can now be seen as the big concrete pillars on which at the top the railway line rests to this day. So these, where the earth was then filled in with solid concrete. And these big pillars gradually crept up and up and up at a terrific height. We then had to build, with bamboo once again, we then had to build these structures of a great height, what you would call scaffolding here in England, metal scaffolding. It was done with bamboos. And there are today actually pictures of that structure, which was taken obviously by a Japanese cameraman for propaganda purposes. But I've seen that picture, and it's on one of a prisoner of war books, of which I cannot just at the moment recall the name of that. But I believe that is bamboo and machino. But you'll see that structure on that picture, and that was where we, like ants, climbed up onto this structure and we worked on these concrete pylons. When they eventually got to the top of these pylons, they were shaped off at the top of these big concrete pylons. I forget how many spans there were across that bridge now, but there was quite a number of these concrete piles, which can be seen, as I said, today. And the rails, and so it was the rails on the top of the concrete pylons were obviously in cutouts of which these rails rested. And then, of course, the sleepers, wooden sleepers, were and structures were put from one pile to the other and cross-membered with the railway sleepers on which the rails would eventually rest. So that, in effect, is what is now called the bridge over the River Kwai, and of which Colonel Tozzi was depicted in that infamous film called The Bridge Over the River Kwai.
What did you think of that film? I mean, it's obvious what you think of it, but could you explain why you're so irritated by that film?
The irritation, though, is because it was fictitious, and that depicted who I have just said are Commandant Colonel Philip Tozzi. And that was not by name, but by the man in charge of the River Kwai. And that depicted him as being a man who wanted to keep the bridge over the River Kwai, where, of course, in effect, that this is the last thing that Colonel Philip Toosey would ever want to happen. His main thing, of which we all realise when we're working on that bridge, that at some time in the future that it would be blasted by our Air Force once the European campaign had finished, which we all hoped it would be. So we felt that being fictitious and showing what this man in charge of the bridge was trying to do was a reflection on the true character of Colonel Philip Toosey, who we all respected. Not a man who was a prisoner of war would have we would have done anything for him, and we felt that that was a terrible film to depict such a man as Colonel Philip Toosey, and that's why we strongly object to a film such as what the populace of today think was the true story of the bridge over the River Tokwai. They will not look upon it as a fictitious thing. They will not in any way understand the suffering of the people and the prisoners of war who built it. And the Japanese sadistic guards that were our guards at that particular time. In no way did that give a true picture whatsoever, and therefore we strongly object to it. That's our reasons.
Now, what did you think, I should have asked earlier, you mentioned it, what did you think of the Japanese commandant? Was it Saito?
Saito. Saito himself. If I say from just a common or garden private, if you like to put it that way, as looking upon that man, he seemed a man of some bearing. He appeared to be quite a quiet man, in a way, though of course he had to carry out his duties under instruction of the Japanese High Command. With whatever they asked him to do, he would obviously have to do. But my impression of him was, on what I saw of him, and I didn't quite honestly see a lot of him. He was not didn't appear to be the bullying type of commandant which in other camps who would kill you as soon as look at her. He didn't impress me as being that type of man. Although he did have to put our Colonel Philip Toosey in his place by whatever means I suppose was instructed by his superiors to do. He was a sergeant actually, but he had the look and the dress of an officer. To me, I couldn't comment on him as being a nasty bit of works at all, but it was probably well known by historians, in as much as if we relate to Colonel Philip Toosey, that during the time I was a prisoner of war, unbeknown to me and other prisoners, there were, I can't remember whether there was three or four men who had decided to escape, which was a fatal thing to do, but it's a very brave thing to do, actually, because they know that they would be put to death. There was no ifs and buts about it. Well, evidently, they had, with Colonel Toosey, had stated what they wanted to do. And in no way would Colonel Toosey, a British officer, stop anybody escaping. That was our duty to do so, even if death was the resultant thing. But it was a brave, but it was a foolhardy thing to do. And so Colonel Toosey, when these men escaped overnight, he in no way did he inform the Japanese that they had escaped. He was going to try and keep, for the length of time in which they were away, to give them that chance. Well, every time that we came in from working parties, we were counted. We were counted when we went out, we were counted when we went in. And we had to count in Japanese. And some chaps just could not get the language at all. And if you started off, which was Ichini, Sanchigo, Rukisisi, Hachiku, Ju, which is up to 10. And every prisoner of war now will tell you exactly what I've just told you. And they can quote those numbers off just like that. Because if you didn't, and you got to a certain number and you didn't know it, you were simply bashed up. They would bash you up. That was their way of telling you you've got to learn. Some poor chaps who are very dumb, they used to get bashed up quite frequently. So we used to try if we could to keep them in the first numbers, which they could say Ichi Ni San, which is 1, 2, 3, you see. And if they were in that, they were perfectly safe. But going back to the prisoners who escaped. So therefore, it was when during one of these counting, a few days after, I can't tell you how many days, after they had escaped, that they realised there was not the numbers in the camp. There was a great to-do. There was much pulling and shouting at night time. We were all ordered out of our huts to stand and be counted. And we stood there virtually for hours while they were just going berserk, the Japanese. Well, Colonel Tozzi then stepped forward and had to say that these men had escaped and that he was, in a way, he had knowledge of their escape. So that was it. So they took Colonel Tozzi away. I don't know what sort of torture that they gave him by interrogation. The Japanese secret police were called Kempi Ties. I don't know how you spell that. Kempi Ties. Kempi. Probably K-E-M-P-I. I don't know. Kempi Tie. And they were secret police. And they were brutal people. And that was why that was... they had the most brutal people intentionally as their secret police. And they obviously tortured him in what way, I don't know. But I do know that he finished up standing all day long in the boiling sun at attention. And this was one of the things that they did to Colonel Tozzi. And it had to be on the orders, most unfortunately, of Saito, our Jap commandant. This, which I will tell you further along, what type of man he really was and what Colonel Tozzi really thought of him, which would be amazing when I do tell you, actually.
Now, did the men get away, the party?
Oh, sorry, yes. So, eventually the men were captured, as anybody would know that they were. I think they were, once again, as I told you, there was no white people in the country. They were conspicuous wherever they went, and they were simply sold off by the native for ties, for whatever. They were captured. They were brought back into our camp, and they were tortured by the Kempi Tai. And I could hear their screams, you know, as they were being tortured. But they were then taken away, and I remember those men to this day, that when they came out of that hut, they came in single file with Japanese guards each side of them, and they walked with their heads high to show the Japanese that although they'd been tortured and that sort of thing, and that they were still soldiers of the British Army. They were taken away by the Japanese guards. And as I understand it, they were made to dig their own graves. And once they had dug their own graves, they were then bayoneted and buried. Now, whether they were buried whilst they were still alive, we won't know to this day. But we heard this through one or two men who had actually witnessed the executions. You know, on working parties somewhere in the jungle. So that was what happened as far as the sator was concerned.
Now, what were you wearing on the working parties of the bridge?
All prisoners of war were issued whilst on this line with a piece of loincloth. This was a narrow piece of cloth. I believe I've already said this actually throughout the narration, and it has two pieces of tape.
This, the snap rag or the...
Yeah, two pieces of tape on this piece of cloth, and you tie the tape around your middle, and you would then get the piece of cloth to be hanging at your back. You would then put your hand between your legs, draw it up to cover up all your necessaries, and you would bring it through the tape, what was tied through. That was the only thing what was issued to us as by way of clothing. That was the normal thing that all prisoners of war had whilst a prisoner of war. I think that was generally throughout the east and far east anyway, where prisoners of war were concerned. That was what they were issued with. We had no Red Cross things where we were at all, although I believe that Red Cross ships, I understand, after the war arrived, with the exception of, we did, I think it would probably be after about 2 years, we did have what was we had now, was it just a tin of something and a packet of cigarettes, and I think that was it as far as the Red Cross was concerned. There was no medical supplies. The Japanese issued very, very small amount of medical supplies. There was insufficient for what was needed for all the sickness and what chaps had. And of course, chaps started then to die. And of course, the reason they were dying in the main was because of the diet that we had. Once again, all these illnesses came about. The beriberi, the diarrhea, and also the various things like malaria, etc., etc., pellagra. These were all things appertaining to malnutrition. Because our diet consisted of rice, of which was measured off in a mug. Some people were fortunate enough to have the mess tins, others weren't, and so you had to eat from whatever you could get, whether that was half a coconut shell or whatever. When you went and lined up for this rice, it was measured in a mug, so you only had a mugful. Unfortunately, then the top of the mug was wiped off with a piece of wood, so it was level with the cup. But rice, being the nature that it is, unfortunately, it would clog inside and leave a big hole, which meant that sometimes, in effect, you only got half a mug and not a full mug. It was a luck of the draw like that. And it was through this poor diet, really, that the malnutrition happened, and all these various illnesses which came from the lack of vitamins, etc., that many people succumbed, and also to the brutal treatment. Some men were bashed to such an extent that they simply died because of the bashings. Many died because of the malnutrition and the work that we had to do. I was in, if I relate to an incident myself, I was in a hut in the Tabakan camp, and I had developed, which was reasonably commonplace as a prisoner of war, a tropical ulcer. A tropical ulcer, by just saying it, doesn't appear to be much, but they are most terrible things to have, because they eat into your flesh at a terrific rate, and they'll eat your flesh away, so that your bones are exposed.
Now, where was this?
This was at Tabakan Camp.
Sorry, where about you? Was it your legs or...?
The ulcer that I developed was on the Achilles tendon. And I was, like the rest of them, I was in a pretty bad state at that time. Most of the work on the bridge by then had been done. So those who obviously had these type of ulcers and that sort of thing were simply just put into a hut, which we simply call the ulcer hut. Now, whilst I was in there, that was perhaps one of the most horrendous things that I had to face up to, was being in that ulcer hut, lying on these split bamboos. We were so close together, lying on these bamboos, we had to lie head to foot. When I lay there, I would squint on occasions my one eye. I'd close one eye and squint along where I could see these men with their legs up on these bamboos. And I could see between the flesh and the bone, daylight between them. And there, the flies were rife, the smell in there was tremendous. Although even that you became accustomed to, but anybody walking in there, that would have floored them, the terrible smell of gangrenous flesh being taken away. The flies would amass inside these in their thousands, and they would be on these legs, etc., and ulcers, and they would lay eggs. And the eggs in next to no time would become maggots, and the maggots would eat into the flesh of these gangrenous legs, and men would call out and that in there. It was whilst I was in this hut that a most marvellous medical officer of the Australian medical corps was the chief medical officer in our camp. He was called Alan Moon, and he came into there and he looked, and he'd done what he could, that man, with very little to go with. And he said to me, your leg, how is it? I said, well, my leg is all swollen, and I'm in a terrific amount of pain.
Did you have a maggot problem, or had you not gone that far?
No, I didn't have a maggot problem at that time. My ulcer that I had was nowhere near what I've just explained, but it was a most painful one. It was eaten in, it would have become that, actually. But what happened, when I pressed the calf of my leg down towards the ulcer, there was a hole in this ulcer, and pus would come out. And so each day I'd push my calf of my leg and push this pus out of the ulcer. And